Can we start with your childhood? Could you tell me a bit about your childhood and what that was like for you?
So 1950, I was the son of an unmarried nurse, Eileen, and my illegitimacy was a source of great distress for her. And I've, strangely enough, only discovered at the beginning of this year who my father was. It turns out to have been an Irishman, a family of doctors and lawyers and whatever. And he's dead now, but I've met my three brothers, would you believe, 2 months ago.
Wow.
It was through my son doing a DNA test, because I thought I was told who my father was many years ago, and it turned out not to be true. He wasn't my father. It turns out that he's Irish. Anyway, so Burnley is was a cotton town, a little bit of coal to fire the mills. Cotton town, some colliers. So there was a big thing in the town between weavers and colliers. But it was a poor town with little going for it except the renowned football club, which I'm a huge fan. And I played there a little bit as a boy, not in the first team, but, you know, junior teams. And I'm very fond of the town, but it was a blessed relief to leave it to go to university when I was 18, simply because there's nothing there really, other than quite a lot of poverty. The town itself is a desperately unimpressive, tired old place with high unemployment. The countryside around it is beautiful. But so I went off to university, I went to a secondary modern school, and I was the first boy from that school to go to university. So I got very lucky. And I didn't do that because I was bright. I did that because, although I was a secondary modern boy, the year beneath me had a grammar school intake because it was on its way to being a comprehensive. And the way they did it was they brought in a grammar school entry for a couple of years, and then it became comprehensive. So the year below me was full of bright boys, boys' Catholic school. And I got to know some of them, and they were very different from the lads of my year, because lads of my year talked a lot about football, a lot more about girls, and not much else really, other than when we got older, started talking about beer. But these younger lads were different, and obviously I dropped down a year, therefore, to do O-levels. So that was really fortuitous. I then left, because they didn't do A-levels at that school, and went to a local college, which was a cramming college. It's called Burnley Municipal College. And it specialised in cramming people through A-levels. And I managed to get sufficient A-levels to go to university, which was another, in 1 year. So it was not because I was clever, but because these teachers were brilliant at telling you what to say in the exam, what to write in the exam. So I then spent quite a long time being an academic, because I thought it was great fun. We had full grants in those days, plus money to spend. So you weren't running up any debts. It was just wonderful. And you didn't have to do a lot of work in the 60s at university. And in fact, it was quite the thing not to do any work to show that you're really clever, because you didn't have to do any work and you could still pass some exams. I went in 68, which was the year of revolution, and we thought we were going to change the world, and it's very, very exciting. And so I stayed on and did a master's degree and then started a PhD. There's another important turning point then, in the second year of my PhD. Do you want to stop there, or do you want me to go on?
No, you can go on. Yeah.
So my first degrees were in politics and international history. But I moved towards becoming what I suppose you could call a social behaviorist. My master's degree was about the influence of travel on political and social attitudes. And because it seemed to me at the time, coming from a place like Burnley, that I wanted to know whether it was true that travel broadened the mind, because I was from a small place and I'd gone to two universities by then. And I suddenly thought, I was meeting a lot of people who were sophisticated. And I couldn't quite work out why they were sophisticated, more sophisticated than I was. And then I realized because they traveled. And in the early, the late 60s, early 70s, to people in places like Burnley, travel was very difficult unless you went to Benidorm for, or Lorette Del Mar, whatever it was called. You know, the international travel never happened. So anyway, so that I became a social behaviorist. That was an incredibly difficult thing to do because it needed a lot of money to go and do social surveys. And I was getting lazy and was playing squash and football and going to the pub most nights. And I thought, I can't do this academic thing. It's not for me. So I was really struggling. And then I discovered that the BBC, by then it was 75, and the BBC, because of the EU referendum that was coming up, wanted to know whether or not the media could influence political attitudes. Because the view was that very few British people really knew much about the European Union, whatever it was called, the EEC, I can't remember now. And that therefore there may be an opportunity because there would be a campaign with both sides arguing one way or the other. People would read newspapers, listen to the news, whether that would influence what people thought. So it was an opportunity to start from kind of zero before it became newsworthy, test people's attitudes, and then test again after the referendum was over. So I was the only person in the entire country doing that kind of political behaviour research. So I got the job at the BBC to do it. And that was great because I was at the great BBC and, you know, this little lad from Burnley. And so I went there and did loads of social surveys and traveled the country asking people questions and so on. Did a report. And then the job was over. And when I went for my assessment, end of year assessment, I was asked by the BBC, bear in mind, was terribly Oxbridge, terribly old-fashioned, and somewhat bohemian in a, not in a particularly pleasant way, a sort of aloof, arrogant, bohemian set of ideas, especially amongst the higher echelons of the producers. So I wasn't particularly keen on it, but it was the BBC. And when I came to my end of year review, I said something about I'd like to move on and move into journalism, political work, because rather than just doing political surveys. And this fellow said to me, "Don't tell me you're one of those bright-eyed young things who wants to work on Panorama one day." And I thought, "You arsehole," because that's exactly what I wanted to do. And because of that attitude, I thought, well, I can't stay here. This, you know, I'm never going to be accepted in this place. So I did a couple of things after. I spent some time in the army, and then I became a school teacher. And I did, you know, for several years, enjoyed school teaching because it was the first proper job I'd ever done, really. Couple of things happened. One was that Maggie Thatcher appeared, and teachers were one of those groups that tried to take her on, like the miners and others. That wasn't a good idea because she was a monster. And so it then became, it wasn't a particularly attractive profession all of a sudden being a teacher. And I was getting on, you know, I was well into my 30s right then, but I was deputy head of a school, in effect, director of studies. And I suddenly thought, I could be doing this for the rest of my life. And it was a very narrow world. I was teaching in East London by then, in Dagenham. And the kids were all right. But, you know, I lived further east in a nicer part, you know, in Hornchurch, Upminster area. But this is a small world. And something began to kick in, which is that my window on the world from being a little lad from Burnley and moving on and going, doing things, my window on the world was BBC documentaries. The great documentaries of the past, like The Ascent of Man by Brunofsky, Alistair Cook's America, Clark's Civilization, and so on. And that they were, it's an extraordinary experience to see complex subjects, fascinating subjects, beautiful subjects presented through the medium of television. And that was very exciting. I was also a big film buff by then, loved films, movies. And so I began to see the world through images, I think. And my pet interest, besides my academic interest, my pet interest was sport, always been sport, because I played sport, reasonable standard at several things, and loved sport and loved watching sport and so on. And it began to occur to me that I thought, why hasn't the BBC done a celebration of sport like they've celebrated science and they've celebrated, you know, their Attenborough's natural history and art and culture and so on? Why haven't they done sport? And it occurred to me that it's because the BBC had this arrogance that sport wasn't important enough to be treated in an intellectual sort of way. And that really annoyed me, because I believe that sport is one of the playing of sport and the enjoyment through sport for almost all of us. I mean, not everyone loves music, not everyone loves art, but most people do, and most people love sport. So why isn't it worthy of a serious treatment? So I then sat down with quite a lot of spare time as a school teacher over a summer holiday, and I wrote the definitive history and celebration of sport, and wrote it as I can't remember how many parts it was. And I sent it to Mark McCormack, who owned and founded IMG, because he had a television company called TWI. I thought, I wonder if he'd be interested. He wasn't interested particularly, but he was very kind. And he said, keep it on file, but you never know, whatever. And I said, well, what do I then do? Because I didn't want to give it up at that point. And bear in mind, I had been at the BBC. And I thought, well, why don't I try the BBC and see if that arrogance is still there? So I knew Cliff Morgan, the great Welsh rugby legend. I knew him vaguely through sporting connections. And by then he'd been head of sport. By then he was controller of BBC One, I think. He was a great guy. So I wrote to him, sent it to him, and he asked me to go and see him, which was extraordinary. And so I went to see Cliff in Kensington House, which is where all the great documentary makers were. Will Wyatt was head of documentaries, and, you know, all the legends were there. And so I went to see him, and he said, you know, I can't do his Welsh accent, but he told me some great rugby stories, because he was a great raconteur, and he loved telling stories. And I sat and listened to him for a while, telling me great, which I won't repeat because they take too long, but great stories about Richard Burton and Stanley Baker and whatever. And I was enthralled. And he said, well, listen, I think this is really quite interesting. And he said, I'll send it to Will Wyatt. And he said, come on, let's go and have a drink. So because he liked a drink. So we then went for the drink, and I somewhat got lashed that afternoon in the Ken House bar with a wonderful chap called Mike Begg. Mike Begg was a legend because he'd done the first major live outside broadcast of the climb of the Old Man of Hoy, which is that stack off the Hebrides, wherever it is, when Bonington and Brown climbed it live on television. And he was there. He was a serious drinker. So we had this great time together. And I suddenly felt, well, I'm part of this BBC world, and these are top guys. So and then managed to stagger home. And the next morning I thought, well, that was a great experience, and I'll put that in my locker and remember it one day. Anyway, 3 days later, the head wasn't very well, and I was covering for him. This is a big comprehensive school in Romford. And his secretary put a call through to me. He said, I've got a chap on the line wants to speak to you. He's called George Carey. And I thought, shit, George Carey, he was called Two Brains Carey. He was a terribly pucker chap. And he founded Newsnight. That's how important he was. And to give you a sense of his bravura, the first episode of Newsnight, when he launched it, and bear in mind Thatcher was prime minister, was an analysis of Thatcher as a prime minister. This is the BBC Newsnight, which is pretty controversial. That's how good a guy he was. Anyway, he said, listen, would you come and see me? And it was terrifying enough to speak to him on the phone, but even more terrifying to go and see him at Ken House. And I won't persevere with the accent, but anyway, he said, this treatment you've written, where did you get it all from? I said, well, it's my passion. I know a lot about it. He said, well, that's quite interesting, because Will Wyatt, the head of the department to whom he reported, has just asked me to put together a team to do the BBC's definitive celebration of sport. How about that coincidence? And he said, what are your circumstances? I said, well, I'm a teacher and a deputy head of a school. He said, look, the problem is I can only offer you a month because we need to get the funding for this. If it's going to happen, some American money likely to help us, but it's not a done deal yet. But I can't offer you more than a month. And I said, don't worry, I'll take it. I wasn't going to turn that down under any circumstances. So I did.
Yeah.
I up and left. And the BBC eventually made that after I then worked on that for a while. And ultimately, it didn't work out because the American money didn't arrive. It paid for me for a bit, but then it all faded away. But by then, I'd made a reputation for myself within documentary features as being efficient and organized. Because obviously, being a school teacher, academic, and a little bit of time in the army, I had disciplines that all these bohemians didn't have because they could never find anything. And they never did their research properly. And I used to have filing cabinets and fill them with relevant, and yeah, I could find stuff. So I did go and work on Panorama, would you believe? Which was great. And I worked with some wonderful people who were my mentors on Panorama. But anyway, ultimately, that thing didn't get made. Now, while I was working on this BBC documentary, there was a chap, a South African chap there, who was very highly thought of. He'd been an anti-apartheid campaigner and had to leave South Africa, and the BBC gave him a job, and he did a bit of presenting on Newsnight. And he called in by one that said, Mark McCormack, who, funnily enough, maybe prompted by my note a few years earlier, had wanted to start a program called Trans World Sport, which was an international sports magazine program. He'd worked out that television was going to become global, not parochial, because it was very parochial in those days. You know, I'm talking about the early 80s, well, mid 80s. You'd got people like Des Lynam, for example, on the BBC, refusing to pronounce Ruud Gullit's name correctly because he was a foreign. So he called him Ruud Gullit. And that was typical of the BBC's attitude that, you know, if it wasn't Division One football in the UK, in England, it wasn't worth watching, or a bit of horse racing, a bit of cricket. But as for Italian football or NFL, forget it. Who the hell's interested in that? So, but McCormack realised that was going to change because television was privatisation of television was happening. We're all over the world, and people were getting much easier access to global sport, and there was an appetite for it. I don't know if you remember that Channel 4 did sumo wrestling at one point, which had developed a cult following, and then, you know, they did NFL and so on and so forth. So anyway, the South African guy's called Marshall Lee, and he and I went to TWI, IMG, TWI to make this bloody program, which was 87. And it was a huge hit. It was a very simple formula. We made it and wrote it in such a way that we sent off a tape every Wednesday morning to all these countries that would buy it with a script, which could easily be translated into Spanish, Italian, Japanese, or whatever. But because the menu was universal sport, once you'd put a foreign voice on it, it could be exactly the same, and nobody could actually work out where it was made because it didn't. We didn't have English football in it. We had Spanish football and Italian football and Formula One. Anyway, and on. And it was a big, big hit. And so that was the beginning of my television career. I did lots and lots of different things there, both sport and non-sport, and did that for many years. I made the history of the Olympics and history of Wimbledon, history of football, you know, a big, big documentary thing. And then, you know, that started to change as, you know, as I got older and things moved on. Do you want me to carry on?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So, having made Transworld Sport for a long time, I wanted to make all these documentaries that I'd always aspired to. By then, my original idea had sort of transformed into this. And the BBC had eventually made a second-rate program called Sport and Mankind in the hands of journalists because it was basically a critique of sport, not what I wanted to do. And it went out and it was, you know, it disappeared rapidly. Made by people who I'm very friendly with, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. So almost the first thing I wanted to, well, there was then financial issues that Transworld Sport wasn't making Mark enough money. So he wanted me to cut the budget. Not because it wasn't doing well, but because he realized it was doing very well. But he was giving me an enormous amount of money every week to make it. But if he gave me less, he'd make even more money. So he gave me less. Yeah. And so I then had a group of people who needed work. So two or three of us who were mad about football, by then I'd developed a really good relationship with FIFA and FIFA's archive and so on. And so I persuaded my bosses to allow me to make a history of football sanctioned by FIFA. So we made a big documentary history called The People's Game, which was a huge hit, made Mark a lot of money, made FIFA happy. And then I was off doing all these other documentaries about big sports. And eventually did Blood, Sweat and Glory, which is my celebration of world sport, exactly as I wanted to do it, which was also a big hit. But then that was great. But by then also developed a wonderful relationship with the IOC and people there. We got on really well. We had a similar vision about how magical sport was and how wonderful the Olympic Games were. So there was a meeting of minds. So I started to do work for the IOC. I started to do a camera of record, which was like a wedding video of each Olympic Games for the IOC to show to their friends and families at Christmas, whatever it was. And then I started OTAB, which was the Olympic archive for the IOC and so on. And a lot of that involved collecting up all the official films of the Games from 1912 onwards, Leni Riefenstahl and her great film Olympia, 1936, and Bud Greenspan's great film 1984, 16 Days of Glory, which is an epic film. And so a lot of that involved 35mm work. And so I needed someone who understood film and how to find the Olympic archive and so on. And brought in a chap called Adrian Wood, who was a wonderful film researcher. And over the years, he did mainly 20th century, a lot of Second World War research. He noticed that he was coming across mainly 16mm Kodachrome, which is an amateur stock, 16mm. Obviously, it's only half as good as 35. The 35 boys in the newsreels didn't like 16mm because it wasn't good enough definition. So they let the 16 go into the amateur market, home movie market. but nevertheless, it was, you know, it was being shot and processed from 1933, 4 onwards, and it was there. And there were people going off to the Second World War, Germans and Brits and others, shooting stuff in color. So he came into my office one day with 6 minutes of kind of VHS and said, have a look at this. And it was a series of highlights of the Second World War in color. It was like that moment in Jurassic Park. We're going to make a fortune. Remember the one? The guy gets eaten by the T-Rex. and then so we started the whole in color thing, which was an extraordinary success. And we did Britain at War in Color, America at War in Color. And it was all real color film. But importantly, there wasn't enough to do a full history of the war. So we did snippets of things and we hung it together by using the technique pioneered by Ken Burns, the great maker of Civil War, who, if you remember, I think he did 13 hours of the American Civil War just using photographs, which was special. And it was a massive hit in the States and a massive hit here as well. And he strung it together very cleverly with good music, but most importantly, and he put some sound effects on by getting people like Meryl Streep, Jason Robards, Martin Sheen, Tom Cruise to read letters and diaries from the Civil War. And it was so powerful because although there were stills, and he would zoom in on the still, there was an emotion from the way the letters and diaries were read that were captivating. So I thought, well, I'm going to use that technique. And that's really important because of what I've done later, to string it all together. And I became a passionate believer in witness, in that it would add personal, emotive spice to a story, to stories that otherwise would have to be done in an academic way with a lot of analysis and facts and, you know. And then once those were all done, I'd kind of exhausted everything I wanted to do in documentary work. And things were changing at IMG, TWI, Mark McCormack had died, and the whole place changed. And so I left, and I went to another company for a while to work for a friend of mine. But ultimately, Lucy and I had twin boys by then, and I didn't want them to be brought up in London. We didn't want them to be brought up in London. And so we decided to move, and we ran our own little production company for a while. And I did a lot of Asian histories. I did Vietnam. I did Korean War. I did Japan, a couple of Japan things, history of India and various things. But again, always using witness-based things and almost always in color as well. But it was hard trying to run a documentary production company living in Somerset. And I thought, well, what can I do to keep the wolf from the door? And by then, I'd fallen in love with words big time. Because in doing the documentaries, I've been really fortunate to work with people like Russell Crowe, Ian McKellen, John Thor, all sorts of really wonderful actors I've gotten, and Martin Sheen, some of whom I can't remember. But I came to understand what they could do with a well-written word. They could give it real power. And I'd never had any, didn't think I'd had any talent writing. I don't think I still do really much because I write by instinct and I write emotively. So I only write things that I think are going to move people in a particular direction, either with a horror about the human nature. Or
if you want to start your own podcast but have no idea where to start, and you want to generate viral social media clips and get your dream guests onto your show, even from just using your laptop in your bedroom like I did,
then my Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is exactly for you. It is a private paid course and community that has every single step and process I've used and continue to use to grow this show. And I include every single secret, every single tactic I do and still use that will get you results super fast. And also, if you want to access me personally every single week, then as part of this course, you'll also be able to join live weekly calls where I go through your podcast and answer your questions to get you results much, much faster. So if you want to actually start a podcast and stop dreaming and get millions of social media views and book your dream guests in half the amount of time it took me, then click the first link in the description. Let's get on to the rest of this episode.
Joy at human achievement. And so I look for things that are going to make the reader engage rather than just telling a story. And so I then began to write around about 2010. And I started with, I looked for where to start. And strangely enough, one day I'd watched Braveheart for the 27th time, or whatever it was, because I love movies. And I thought, why are the English always dorks and the Celts are always heroes? You know, I'm now half Irish, but, you know, the Irish, the Welsh, the Scots are always hero worship, they're heroes. And we don't seem to, really. And so I was looking for an English hero, and I found Hereward the Wake, who is a little known but real hero. And I fell in love with him, and I thought, I'm going to write about him. I'm going to make him the William Wallace of the English. So I wrote this thing called Conquest. It took me forever. I had to have a lot of help to develop what I call the draftsmanship of writing. And eventually I developed a certain technique, although I got a lot of very good reviews of Conquest, but I also got a lot of very bad reviews of Conquest, which I was reading the other day. Some of them are absolutely awful. But I'm a little bit... Anyway, I did four of those with Penguin. And then I did a couple of Great War ones, which is supposed to be of a trilogy. I only did 1914 and 15. And this, sorry, it's supposed to be a quintet, but they didn't sell well enough. And then I did a sort of Northern Ireland IRA SAS thing, which was, you know, I didn't really want to do it because I'd been in Northern Ireland and I didn't really want to do it, but publishers persuaded me. So that was like my last novel. But the publisher said, like, why don't you start doing nonfiction? So I started then with The Great War, which I thought Shadow of War and Darkness and Thunder, 1914-1915, were the best things I'd done, really. But it's very niche. It's a long time ago. And Shadow came out around about the time of the last great celebration of the First World War, when everyone was dead. And it hit the wrong end. It hit the beginning of the end of the market for the First World War stuff. So that was disappointing. And then, again, my publisher has become a good friend. And he said, well, why don't you do something more contemporary? Why don't you do the Second World War? So that was Barbarossa, and they just finished Japan's War. I also do jobbing writing for people. I help with their autobiographies. I write booklets for a friend of mine who pays me to write little booklets on certain subjects. I'll write anything for money, really.
Yeah. Well, you've had just gone through your entire career story and life story, and it's fascinating to see how varied it is. And it makes me ask kind of, is there a certain kind of confidence you need to have to be able to take that risk and go from teaching to working for the BBC or joining the army?
No, like, it's not confidence. It's not arrogance. Because I think a lot of people I mean, Daley Thompson's a good friend of mine, a really good lifelong friend. And his confidence is verging on the arrogance, you know, on the arrogant. He's always believed he's better, you know, and I admire that. But I'm not that, it's not confidence, arrogance in my part, it's passion.
Yeah.
It's the love of stories, the love of history, and the love of stories and this passion to tell the story and to tell it in a way that will engage with a wider audience than, I mean, I must have read every book there is to read on Barbarossa and Japan now, you know, huge piles of books, and they're dull.
Hmm. Almost. In what way? Hmm? Why are they dull? Why are they dull?
Because they, first of all, they don't have real people in them on the whole. Some do. Some have quotes. But the quotes are only to illustrate the main thrust that the author wants to get across.
Yeah.
They're not there for the sake of the power of the words in the first place. They're there to serve a purpose, his or her purpose, rather than serve a purpose for the audience. I'm interested in the audience. And, you know, I just love it when people say, I read your book and it's so fascinating. And I felt so, you know, horrified by this or moved by that or amazed at, take an example, the Siege of Leningrad, which is just an unbelievable story, or the Einsatzgruppen murderers, the Nazi murder, you know, all that thing, you go, wow. And if you tell it in a particular way and you tell it by largely relying on the experience of the people who were there, it's a different grab. It's, you know, it's a Ken Burns grab. It's an emotional grab. And because all the films I love are all emotional films, you know, all little David Lean or Spielberg or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like Tarantino and all these trendy movies that people, I like movies that make you cry or get you excited or, you know, John Williams music. You know, that's a movie for me. I'm not suggesting I put John Williams music on anything that I've done, but it's, you know, it's the emotional impact that's so exciting. So, yeah, so that's what I do.
And have you got a lot of criticism when you've pivoted in your career or you've gone down the unconventional route, or has everyone been quite supportive of you?
I don't know, really. I don't care what anyone else thinks. Particularly. I've always pursued my own drive. And you see, the thing is, if you're a little lad from Burnley and you carry a chip on both shoulders, the only answer to that is to fight.
Yeah.
And to change it and to move on and to, you know, nobody'd ever gone to university. And so I thought, I'm going to go. It gives you that drive. Not everybody. I mean, all the people, the boys are at school with never left Bournemouth. One or two did. And so they were born into an environment and the environment got a grip of them and didn't let go. I was determined that I was going to get out of the grip of that environment.
And do you think that's innate for you, or do you think that was from outside influences or a bit of both?
Well, nature, nurture. I don't know. I for many, many years, I was a nurturist, as a social behaviorist. Not wanting to go down the trap that, you know, talent can be, you know, there can be racial superiority or genetic superiority. As a you know, 60s socialist, that was anathema to me. And later in life, you know, you begin to wonder sometimes whether some people's wiring is different. You know, you meet someone like Daley, there's nothing in his nurturing that helped him at all. You know, his wiring is definitely different. He's got an extraordinary energy and drive, despite his upbringing. But maybe in some instances, it's the negativity of your upbringing that case hardens you.
Yeah.
A good example is Churchill. Churchill should never have survived childhood. He was treated appallingly. Plus, he was weak, baby-faced, stammered. he had nothing going for him. And I think that made the man of it, it made him this extraordinary leader, this firebrand, this, you know, and he adored his ancestor, the Duke of Marlborough, and wanted and was a warrior leader in the most unlikely circumstances. I mean, if you see pictures of Churchill as a young man, he's never going to be a warrior leader. But I got to know him. I didn't get to know him. He was dead. But I got to know his family pretty well. And there was a lot of him in them, because you couldn't help being a bit like him if you were his granddaughter or whatever. I met his daughter for a while as well. And there was something about his aura, that his charisma, that made me think it's real. You can, if you believe in something enough, I think it tends to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And yes. I say that to, I was at National Film and Television School last week. And I said to them, the best chance you have of succeeding, and we were talking about working in telly, the best chance of succeeding is never to give up and to be totally committed to your passion. And don't let anything or anyone stand in your way.
Yeah.
Because if you, you know, that's all you need. You don't, you know, the rest is learned. You can learn how a camera works, so you can learn how to edit, you can learn how to write, but only if you've got that passion.
Yeah, 100% agree. And what advice do you think maybe a young lad in Burnley in a similar position and upbringing that you had, what advice should they ignore that could potentially keep them in that kind of environment if they want to get out of it? What advice should they ignore?
Well, I mean, all the obvious ones, like, yeah, get these dreams out of your head, get yourself a proper job, you know, all that kind of stuff. Or you're better off here. You don't want to go down to London. It's all different down there. All the posh folk down there. You won't like it down there. Stay here, lad. We, you know, all that. Get it.
Yeah.
Go where you want to go. I used to teach in a school, and there's an old boy there who was a former careers master in the school in Dagenham. And one day Martin Peters went to see him and said, "Now then, Martin, what do you want to do when you leave school?" He said, "I want to be a professional footballer, sir." I said, "Don't be daft, lad. Get yourself a proper job." Of course, you know, he was Martin Peters.
Yeah.
So ignore all that. Go where your dreams want you to go. Travel, see the world, go on adventures. You know, I joined the army not because I wanted to be a soldier, but because I wanted to go scuba diving and jump out of aeroplanes.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't do it now, but I did then.
Yeah. Can we talk more about that? Did you join the SAS specifically?
Well, not at first. I was in 10 para first, which is the reservist paras. And then I applied and then did selection.
Yeah. And what was kind of your experience in the army and the SAS, and how did that change you as a person once you'd left?
Well, it was, you know, the great bits were, you know, training with the Marines, going up the Breckens, doing desert training, winter, you know, all that stuff was great. The downside was Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And I don't ever talk about that, because it's, I'm not proud of what was happening on both sides. You know, it was horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible things were done. And the you know, the Brits were culpable in so many respects, but it's all kicking off again, of course. I'm sure you're reading in Parliament, and not only Afghanistan, where there's terrible reports have come out, but also in Northern Ireland going way back. So I came out of the army, having been pleased to have done it.
Yeah.
And an experience that certainly changed me. It gave me a different perspective on life, a harsh perspective on life, which I didn't have before. And but again, it's like, if anyone young is thinking of a challenge, then go for it.
Mm.
And what psychological traits do you think you need to become a soldier or an elite soldier to get into the SAS? What are some traits that people need if they want to join the Marines or something?
Oh God, stubbornness. It's hard. You got to be young and fit. You can't do it if you're not fit. I was very fit. I didn't like failing. The directing staff, and we had to call them DS. I don't know why. They were pretty well. There were two kinds. There's Jekyll and Hyde. But they pushed you really hard, and you just had to have that resilience, really. You know, they did horrible things to us. Like, I remember the first exercise we did in the Breckens, we drove in a 4-ton truck from Duke of York's barracks. It was the middle of the bloody night in the middle of this forest, and the truck stopped, 4-ton truck. And we're all in the back under canvas. And they said, right, lads, get out. Truck's rolling down. Got to push it. Push this bloody thing about a mile and a half. Because the truck was perfectly fine. We just had to push it. And so we pushed it down into this clearing. And at that point, a lot of the directing staff had lit a big bonfire, and they were keeping warm and having a cup of tea. And we thought, oh, a bit of warmth. And they said, oh, get in those woods, get your head down. The call will be 6 o'clock in the morning. You need to be up and shaved with your boots clean. Fuck off. That's the first day.
Yeah.
And a lot of lads the next morning, jacked.
Really?
Having slept out in the open in the middle of winter in the forest. You just had a poncho over you. You didn't have anything else. So that got rid of a few.
Yeah. And talking about mentioning your documentary, you did a few documentaries on World War II in colour, and they won quite a few really prestigious awards.
Yeah.
And why do you think it was important to show World War II on colour, and why do you think it was such a hit that it was?
Well, it's a phenomenon as you get older, I'm too old now, but as you get older and your kids get older, they will look back at a very odd period in history. From the beginning of film, photographs, which is middle of the 19th century, and then newsreel-type movies right at the end of the 19th century, which is in black and white. So that's what, let's pick a date, call it 1900. Until the beginning of colour television or Technicolour in cinemas, which is not much more than 50 years. That period in history is in black and white. The rest of world history is in colour, which is what we see every day. Now, those people like me were brought up in a black and white world. And, you know, watching World at War, which is in black and white, which is a great series, wonderful series, it didn't seem odd that it was in black and white because telly was in black and white. But increasingly, it will look really odd and it will be rejected because nobody said, well, why am I watching that? Which is why things are being colorized now, of course. And I did some colorizing for Paris, the Paris Olympics, based on the 1924 film, which we colorized to make it, you know, because it was Little and Abraham's and Johnny Weissmuller was games and so on. And it went down really well to colorize it. Because it's more real. I mean, people think. And what Peter Jackson did with the First World War stuff, the Imperial War Museum asked to colorize it, was just brilliant. Made it much more immediate. And when Color of War, as it was called, the first big one on ITV, and then we did Britain at War, which won more awards. ITV did some great posters around London, written by copywriters. And the best line was, war is never in black and white, which is very telling. And so if you pick up almost any book, including mine, certainly Barbarossa, a Second World History now, the cover will... will always be colorized, because if people see a book in black with a black and white cover on the front, they say, I'm not watching, I'm not reading that.
Yeah.
So it taints it as, you know, a dry old history, because the front cover's in black and white. Not watching, not reading that.
Do you think there'll be a counter movement for that, maybe in general, because there's so much almost overload of color and saturation, especially on social media? Changing it to black and white could help.
Good point. There is a purity. I mean, long vinyl has come back.
Yeah.
Even though it's scratchy and it's, you know, whatever, because there's a nostalgia. I suppose it's possible that, I mean, if you think about some of the great, Citizen Kane, for example, beautifully shot, shadow and texture, nuance, and the same with Riefenstahl's Olympia. Because I work closely with the IOC, there's been a campaign to colorize Olympia. There is also a negative campaign saying, you know, you would spoil what Riefenstahl did. And Citizen Kane, would you ever colorize Citizen Kane? Probably not. Although colorization now is getting better and better and better. Maybe one day, I don't know. But you're right, there may well be a purist reaction one day.
Yeah. Mentioning your quartet, your four books, wasn't it to do with the kind of Norman conquest?
Yes, it was subtitled, well, I tried to call it the Making of England series, and it went all the way to Magna Carta. And there was a thread running through the whole thing, descended from Hereward, and a little token thing called the Talisman, which kind of keeps cropping up throughout the whole thing. But the leitmotif, more or less, was that Hereward began a tradition of rebellion, a sort of desire for democracy and freedom within the, has to be the English mentality, because the Celts have gone their own way. You know, you can trace it right through to Chartism and Peasants' Revolt and the widening of the franchise, the Reform Act and so on. I think it's a thread through English history. And so I tried to suggest that Hereward started it, which was a fairly exaggerated thing to do. But it meant that I can string all four novels together by creating either real life descendants of Hereward or people who were inspired by him, and then right up to Magna Carta, which kind of strung them all together.
And do you think those values are still present in Britain today, or do you think it's changing?
Well, God, that's a difficult question. I think Britain has, I have to keep saying England, because now that I'm half Irish, I see, and I know a lot more about Ireland. I see Ireland certainly different. Well, I think the Celts are different, and they have their own history. And, you know, they were all conquered by the English at one point. So that's kind of queered the patch. I think England is losing something. I had a house in France for a long time, and I'm very fond of the French. I love the French. I love their elan, their spirit.
Yeah,
their sense of equality, and they still hold on to their citizenship, the common good, really powerfully. And you only need to watch, you know, only need to know a little bit about French history and French news still going on to realize they're still revolutionaries.
Yeah.
And we aren't anymore. We've become a tired old country, I think.
Why do you think that is? Why have we become more tired and less kind of revolutionary?
I don't know. I mean, you need a long time to discuss that.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it has got to do with not dealing with the end of empire particularly well, and leaving it with so many regrets because of the things that we did. And the fact that having had an empire led to the demographics changing dramatically, where the complexion, the racial cultural complexion of England has changed so dramatically, so that the old English, the middle classes, the home counties, rural England is still old England to a large extent. I mean, I live in rural Somerset, and it's noticeably different there because the outside world isn't, it is in some of the smaller towns, but in the villages, the outside world is not present. Yeah. But when you go to London and when you look at the news every night, urban Britain, urban England has changed so dramatically that our identity has gone with it. And one of the classic mistakes we made, we English, is having conquered the Celts by various methods, we then tried to bring them under an umbrella we call Britain. And they kept their identity within the British umbrella, whether you're Irish, Welsh, or Scottish. They kept their identity despite what we imposed upon them. And it's still, you know, it's really strong now. You only have to go to Murrayfield or the National Stadium when they're playing rugby and hear them sing, realize that they are a nation. But because we subsumed Englishness into Britain, because it was ours and we created it, we've forgotten Englishness. I think we've forgotten the English identity. And if you add to that this diversity between old England, which is all around us, in more, you know, more or less all around us in ideas and attitudes, and especially as we slip more to the right politically, it's becoming stronger. And urban England, which is a sort of cosmopolitan, global world. And I think that's creating terrible division among us, which is creating dissatisfaction amongst a lot of people. Dissatisfaction because they're trying to hold on to old England, or dissatisfaction in New England because we have strange things like a monarchy and a depressed economic situation and, you know, racial and ideological divisions that are making everybody upset, I think. Plus, you know, we've had successive governments that have been unable to do what was done after the Great Depression, you know, New Economics, John Maynard Keynes, John Kenneth Galbraith, how we rebuilt the country economically, got through the Second World War victoriously, created the welfare state after the war. Everything was great then. Even the Tories accepted that status quo. And then it fell apart. And Maggie started it, where we created a self-centered political set of ideas. You know, when she said there's no such thing as society, that was a death knell to a country trying to hold itself together, to say, you know, more or less, was it Basildon Man, every man for himself? Fuck everybody else. Fuck the common good. There is no common good. It's each for us, and the market will take care of all our problems. Well, look at the state we're in now. Our infrastructure is shot at because we've sold our infrastructure off to private money. And nobody knows what to do. And in the last few days with Starmer the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, are falling apart because they've got this huge majority, and everyone was kind of hopeful that for once, you know, we could have a new Blairite way forward. And they're less than a year in and it's collapsed. So people think, bloody hell, why would you be interested in politics, or why would you care about anything if, you know, there's no leadership that's... And what are we doing? We're opening the door to Nigel Farage to be the next incumbent in Downing Street.
Do you think that's where it's going to go in the future, next election?
I'd be very surprised if it doesn't go that way. I mean, everything that Starmer's getting wrong, Farage will have an answer to. You know, the number of migrants coming over is 40% up than last year in boats. He'll just say all the obvious things. We're going to cut taxes. We're going to get rid of waste. We're going to close the borders, We're going to be really hard on immigration. You know, he'll say all those right-wing things. It'll say, yep.
Thank you, Stuart. Really appreciate your time.
Lovely to talk to you.
Are you working on anything? Any new books? I know you just released one on Japan.
No, I am starting a magnum opus. I'm going to do Blood, Sweat and Glory, which I did as a documentary. I'm writing it as a book. It's hugely illustrated by images. It's going to be a coffee table book.
Brilliant. And where can people go if they want to find your work?
Well, there's stuff on my website, Lips. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff on YouTube. My books are in the shops still. Yeah.
I'll leave the links to your website and books in the show notes below. Yeah, really appreciate your time, Stuart. Thank you very much.
Got to the end of this video, then you're literally in the top 1% of minds on the planet. You're curious, you love podcasts, and you love this show, but you also probably want to start your own show as well. And this is the exact same position I was in about a year or two ago, where I consumed so many podcasts and loved every second of it. But in the back of my mind, there was always that thought, I want to start my own show. But the problem was, all these podcasters that I listened to didn't have a step-by-step blueprint that would help me avoid the mistakes that they've made and create my own pro show like the ones that I listened to from them in a fast amount of time. Luckily for you, I've solved this problem for you. I've created my step-by-step pro remote podcast blueprint for the kind of person who wants to start a podcast from scratch but has no idea of what equipment to use, how to find guests, how to actually record it, even on their laptop if they live in the middle of nowhere and don't have a studio, which, let's be real, most of you probably don't have and you don't actually need, and want to grow their show fast, generate viral social media clips, and actually turn podcasting into not just a dream, but a genuine career that they can make money from. So if you're interested in this, it is literally a video course that goes through every single step and process that'll get you from no idea of how to start a show, no idea how podcasting works, to a pro remote podcaster who has the potential to generate viral social media clips and get their dream guests on their show in a matter of weeks. And as well as the video course, you'll also be able to join live weekly calls with me, where I'll go through your show and give you personalized feedback of how to improve to get you results much faster. You'll also get access to the AI email templates, the AI research templates, the title and thumbnail templates I use to get super high personality guests, super high performing guests, and at a really, really good conversion rate. A lot of the emails I send do end up getting yeses for people coming onto the show, as well as generate super engaging thumbnails and titles, and also generate viral social media clips. For example, one of my social media clips got 1 million+ views on Instagram and TikTok, the same clip. So this is proof that it works. And if you want to get all of this and genuinely become a pro podcaster super fast, even from your bedroom, then this is for you. And alongside my templates, you'll also get an ebook, which goes into even more detail about not just my show and how to create your own pro show, but also other successful shows and the tactics that they do to blow up on social media and generate a loyal audience that they can actually teach, but also make a career from as well. So if you're interested, then it's the first link in the description. You won't regret it. I know you've been dreaming of creating a podcast your entire life, or for at least a year, 6 months. And this is the best opportunity you're going to get. And I don't know any other pro podcaster that I listen to, that I love, that has a step-by-step blueprint of the exact things they do to grow and continue to succeed at their show. So this is the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for you. Right now, it might have changed if you're watching this a few months later, but right now, you can get the founder's pre-sale price. And basically, once 25 members join the community, the price will double. And also, if you don't feel satisfied with the course and with the community, and you have followed all the steps, taken all the notes, taken all the action, and if you don't feel like you're at least five times more confident at podcasting and don't have a remote pro show all set up and ready to get your dream guests on to your show and create a super awesome podcast, then I'll give you your money back, no questions asked. So if you're interested, first link in the description, your future self will thank you. I'll hopefully see you there. Goodbye.